sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
First thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound. No one could change my mind, but Mama tried. One and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my Mama seemed to know what lay in store. Despite my Sunday learning, toward the bad I kept turning, till Mama couldn't hold me anymore. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried, Mama tried. Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. Leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried. Dear old daddy, rest his soul, left my mom a heavy load. She tried so very hard to fill his shoes. Working hours without rest, wanted me to have the best. She tried to raise me right, but I refused. I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried, Mama tried. Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. Leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried. One of our columnists tonight is prison activist Anthony Rayson, so I thought I'd pick a prison song. Or a song about ending up in prison. You know, I'm used to the version by the Grateful Dead, but when I went hunting for lyrics, I discovered that Merle Haggard wrote that song. So I listened to his version, and it's pretty darn good. The prison situation, on the other hand, is not good. Not good at all. Here in the freedom-loving U.S. of A., we lock up more people than any other country in the world. It's turned into an immensely profitable industry. The incarceration rate is still steadily climbing. Last year, the federal prison population went down just a little, but the states and counties made up the difference, so there was an overall increase. It's shameful. Torture and killing are the order of the day in prisons. Some of it comes from the inmates, but a huge amount is from the guards, the system. They keep it freezing cold, but they don't give you enough blankets. They barely provide enough food to live on. What they do provide tastes bad and is unhealthy. Not even any privacy to go to the bathroom. The whole system is set up to demean, to destroy. I'm disgusted. They lock people up for guns, for drugs, for feeding the homeless, for protesting against things that are wrong with the system. We must change the prison system into something that targets only the true criminals, not hapless victims of society or people that stand up for change. And if we're going to make that happen, we need to take away the profit. No one should be making money locking others up. We need to take away that profit so there's more incentive for those in power to keep people out of prison than inside. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we stream live every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Don't forget, Revolution Radio is listener-supported, so hop on over to freedomslips.com and give them a donation or buy one of their products. They've got some great swag, and they produce many, many great shows. I'm proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guests Larry Pinkney, Anthony Rayson, Phil Ferruggio, and M.K. Davis. And so tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Benton, Mississippi, Minneapolis, Chicago, and wherever you are. Required reading by Jim Fetzer at Veterans Today, Boston Show Trial, along with Faking the Boston Bombing, How It Was Done. Let them call me a rebel and I welcome it. I feel no concern from it, but I should suffer the misery of demons should I make a whore of my soul, Thomas Paine. Movements are like this. They are grassroots, often underground, and they start with crazy people who are willing to believe in the impossible. Movements never start in corporate offices with executives drawing up a master plan. If we truly want to see the world change, we must begin as a band of madmen, welcoming other crazy people who want to be a part of something bigger than themselves. Neil Cole. We continue with our mini-series regarding A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America. It's a book. The culmination of all of this is Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett and the False Flag Weekly News on No Lies Radio every Thursday. They are the evolved media. We know that today's newspapers, radio, TV are garbage, as well as the current version of what passes for alternative media, The Nation, The Progressive, NPR, Alternet, Rachel Maddow, Goodman, Jon Stewart, if not garbage, at least suspicious, very suspicious. But what we want to do is to say something in this mini-series here about the history of the alternative press, the beginnings that have evolved into Fetzer and Barrett. More from the book. Americans love heroes. We thrive on legends of lonely fighters for people's justice. The ragged kids at Concord, breaking up the King's contingent of Andy Jackson and his backwoods boys, destroying the most magnificent army ever to land in North America at the Battle of New Orleans. David and Goliath used to be our national parable. But if our historical heroes are Davids, why is our vision dominated by Goliaths? One reason is that whatever the campaigns of our Davids may be, it is the Goliaths who write the histories, publish the newspapers, operate the broadcasting stations, and make the movies. They organize the world according to the Goliaths' needs. In the modern world, that means high technology and bureaucracy, which means orthodoxy and predictability, and above all, preservation of a status quo favorable to giants. Historically, our culture's treatment of its Davids has not been kind. The politicians, writers, and artists who have been broken through barriers to change have not had an easy lot. This was true during the American Revolution, as in that extraordinary period we call the 60s. Tom Paine is considered a mythic revolutionary hero. School children today are taught about his brave polemic pamphlets for freedom and that George Washington said the revolution could not have been won without him. Paine was contemptuous of elite power and preached that the only legitimate government was one controlled by common people and that served the common people. His insulting depictions of King George III shocked proper Americans, but in the end, it helped destroy the residual belief in the divine right of kings. There was an echo 190 years later when activists heaped indignities upon Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon in the attempt to demystify imperial presidencies. After the revolution, Paine went back to England to sow the seeds of power to the people abroad. He criticized the British government and supported the French Revolution. Indicted for treason, he escaped to France with the help of William Blake. In France, Paine again got into trouble by denouncing the terror in favor of constitutional government. Paine was condemned to die but escaped the guillotine only because the terrorists were careless. Nothing deterred Paine from his ideals. He criticized his old compatriots, George Washington, for excessive militarism. The proper Bostonian, John Adams, one of the few Harvard graduates to support the revolution, called him the filthy Paine. Fashionable young men of London had their cobblers form the initials TP with nails on their boot heels so they could grind Paine into the dirt with every step. Paine returned to the United States where he died poor, sick, and abandoned. Paine was the first in a distinguished line of speakers of disturbing ideas and taunters of authority who do not fade into the golden sunset in warm glory and beatification. They are usually crushed or co-opted or they destroy themselves. Truth, usually in the form of truth tellers, gets dashed to earth. It does rise again, but only at considerable cost to those who resurrect it. So it was in the beginning of the Republic, and so it was 190 years later. Next week, the incredible, creative, and chaotic period labeled the 1960s was not the American Revolution, though some of its activists thought it was. A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America, continuing next week.
And now, It is again time for that popular American game show on CBS, Take the Money and Run, sponsored by Getaway Cruise Lines, with your host, D.B. Cooper, where our guests will take the money from the rich and give it to the poor, from the big banks, from the elites, where we will see a righteous redistribution of wealth, commando style, as it were. And now, please welcome your host, D.B. Cooper. D.B.? Mr. Cooper? Hello? Can someone please check behind the curtain and perhaps in Mr. Cooper's dressing room, quickly? Maybe take a look at the money in the studio bank vault as well? And now the New American Dream Real History Channel, sponsored by Artifact Ripped Up Jeans. They really look really, really old. Tonight, Father Larry Rosebaugh. We've often talked about Larry Rosebaugh and how he was a part of the successful raid on Fort Benning to broadcast the words of Oscar Romero. Here's a little more about the life of Father Larry Rosebaugh, written by famous American war tax protester Carl Meyer. What a watershed was 1968, the year of the famous Battle of Chicago outside the Democratic Party's National Convention in August. That summer, Larry went truant from the vocation of high school teacher and plunged into the Catholic worker movement. He came for the summer to watch over our St. Stephen's house in Chicago during a period of crisis and transition for my family. After our neighborhood became a war zone for a while following the murder of Martin Luther King in April. In August, he got permission from superiors in his order to join the dynamic Casa Maria Catholic worker community in Milwaukee, led by Michael and Annette Cullen. Mike drew him into the Milwaukee 14 action, burning 1A draft files taken from a selective service office there. This led to 22 months in jails and prisons, including 10 months in the hole at Waupun State Prison for resisting the prison labor system there. After 3 years of various travels and adventures around North America, Larry set out on a two-month pilgrimage, hitchhiking and walking south toward Recife, Brazil, where he would begin 3 decades of incarceration and service among the poorest of the poor in Latin America. I received annual letters from him for many of these years through the efforts of his best friend and supporter, Mary Lou Peterson, letters full of heart-wrenching stories and experiences. In Recife, Lorenzo lived on the streets with destitute homeless people, sometimes on the steps of the cathedral. With the blessings and encouragement of the saintly Archbishop Dom Helder Camara, Lorenzo scavenged for food with them, prepared soup over open fires, tended to wounds and industries. Once he and a Mennonite fellow worker were arrested and jailed for allegedly stealing the cart they used to collect vegetables. They were brutally beaten by inmate stool pigeons before being cut loose through the intercession of Dom Helder Camara after their absence from their usual haunts was discovered. After 6 years in Brazil, a deadly bout with hepatitis caused his return to the U.S. for rest and recuperation. Back here, he soon got involved in nonviolent action at the Pantex nuclear bomb assembly plant near Amarillo, Texas. This led to a year in federal prisons. While in jail in Amarillo, he received a pastoral visit from Bishop Leroy Matheson. Shortly afterward, Bishop Matheson spoke out to condemn the manufacture of nuclear weapons at Pantex, urging employees to quit and offering to help them find better employment. Then in the summer of 1983, Larry joined Father Roy Bourgeois and Linda Ventimiglia in the earliest nonviolent action protest at the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, a series of 4 protest actions inside the base that culminated when they climbed a tall pine tree to broadcast recordings of sermons of the martyred Archbishop Oscar Romero, over the barracks housing Salvadoran soldiers and training at the school. This led to another year in federal prisons for the three of them. Out of jail again in 1984, Lorenzo teamed up with Kathy and Phil Dalbredine to begin a mission of incarnation in Cuauhtémoc, state of Chihuahua in Mexico. In 1986, he moved on to El Salvador, where he served 4 years as pastor of a parish in the town of Estanzuelas in southern El Salvador. The country was still in the throes of a savage civil war that made Catholic ministry there dangerous and challenging. Lorenzo moved on to serve another 2 years as pastor to a community of refugees returning from camps in Honduras. People were viewed as dangerous guerrilla sympathizers by the government and armed forces of El Salvador. In the spring of 1992, Lorenzo left El Salvador, returned to the U.S. by bicycling through Guatemala and Mexico. 1993, he accepted pastoral assignment to a mission of the Oblates in the Ixcan region of northern Guatemala. Lived among the poor indigenous people of this region and ministered to them for 7 years, then returned to the U.S. to care for his aging mother. Near the end, he says, "When I reflect on my 7 years in Guatemala, I find even now my heart remains in Guatemala. After being back in the United States over 2 years, I feel sort of like a fish out of water." And he ended up going back.
On May 18, 2009, Larry was driving a vehicle in Guatemala with other oblates as passengers and was killed in an armed robbery. Our friend, our beloved brother in the Catholic worker movement for over 40 years, Lorenzo Rosbaugh, was shot and died on a roadway in the Ixcan region of northern Guatemala in what appeared to be a carjacking robbery by two armed attackers, but could have been an intentional political killing. It is hard to know in Guatemala today where economic and political conditions are so desperate that both criminal violence and political killings are common. This has been the New American Dream Real History Channel, sponsored by Artifact Ripped Up Jeans. They're really cool because they look really, really old. Our first guest of the night is M.K. Davis. M.K. Davis has been researching the Patterson Sasquatch film for the past 18 years. Chuck will be getting M.K. on the line real soon, and I'll just keep going here for a little bit. He has traveled extensively and has amassed one of the largest collections of images from the film. MK has trekked the Bluff Creek drainage of Northern California on many occasions, and his observations have led to several important discoveries on the film itself. Hello.
Well, hello, MK, and welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. You are on the air.
Okay, well, let's get after it then. What I want to talk about today is particularly in the field of cryptids or cryptozoology, existentialism. And now existentialism is kind of like this. You know, I believe it if I see it, I hear it, I touch it, or I smell it. But as I'm involved, I don't believe in it. And you see quite a bit of that in existentialism, if I can say the word, in cryptozoology. And I remember a fellow that had a Bigfoot experience. He was a stand-up comedian, naturally, and for his profession. But it was so profound for him that he believed so incredibly strong in this experience. And when I saw the video, I hardly could tell anything about it. But yet, when it came to the Patterson film, which was a much better video, he had no stock in it at all because he personally wasn't involved in the Patterson event. So existentialism is, you find it throughout cryptozoology. You know, right now in the Bigfoot community, there seems to be a bit of a lull, not too much going on. There is a show called Survivor Man who's featuring several episodes on Bigfoot. And it looks like that the man who is the Survivor Man is Les Stroud. It looks as if he is giving the Bigfoot subject a fair assessment. He's not, using it as a vehicle for self promotion, but he's really giving it a good go, and I hope that he continues to do so. Now, he's not totally convinced that Bigfoot exists, but he had some personal experiences while he was shooting the series out in the woods alone, and it leads him to believe that they could possibly exist. So whether or not something exists, if you're going to be an existentialist, there's 7 billion people on the earth. And if for all 7 billion to go and have an encounter with every animal or living thing on the earth so that they could see it, smell it, breathe it, or whatever, that's not possible. So, existentialism, everybody can't be that way or we'd never learn anything. We have to take the word of others, at least to some degree. There's lots of animals that I haven't seen. I can open up a book on zoology and just flip through it and show you animal after animal, but I believe that book. And likewise with documentary filmmakers. They would be out of business if everyone was an existentialist. They make their living documenting animals, documenting people, documenting events, and they are counting on you to believe them. And their reputation for believability is on the line, and it's very important to them. So we do have a certain amount of belief that we put in what other people tell us. And likewise, it is with Bigfoot in particular, if any single piece of evidence is going to catapult us to an unknown into the arena of the known, it would have to be inarguable. And we're talking about classification. There have been some attempts to classify Bigfoot, even though he hasn't been proven yet. There's a number of professional people or academics that have donned the mantle of Bigfoot researcher or Bigfoot expert or even foremost Bigfoot expert. And what does that mean for a person to have a degree and embrace something like this? Now, if a Harvard professor states that Bigfoot is a Gigantopithecus, yet his evidence for that notion is less than adequate to prove it, does the weight of his professorship force the cryptid into the 8th column in the Book of Known Evidence? Well, fortunately, this is not how classification works, and we can be assured that if and when the evidence of such quality and quantity does surface, we will know Bigfoot for what he, she, or it really is, and there will be no more worries on that front. We can be grateful that classification is not based upon the qualifications of the classifier, but by the quality and the quantity of the evidence. So nothing will be misclassified because someone with an academic degree swears to it. We can all breathe free. Some of the best minds have gone in search of the Sasquatch with little or no results. What would make a person think that he or she could succeed in such an endeavor when so many have failed? What would make a person even want to go down that road? Well, obviously, there's some inner need to connect with what a Sasquatch represents to them, and it's sort of that same way to me, except that I most of my work has been with the Patterson Bigfoot film, and that sort of leads me to the second part of my little diatribe here. The Patterson Bigfoot film, I've been researching that film since 1997, and incredibly as it might seem, it is still yielding surprises. Now, here recently, I have reconstructed the film, and I've used a new type of technique called deblurring, and I used it along with some cutting-edge enhancement techniques, and it's about a 20-step process per frame, and you know how many frames a film of that length carries. So it took me a good while, but I finally got this strip of film put back together, and I brought it, hand-stabilized it as accurately as I possibly could. And I am just flabbergasted at how incredibly, how much clearer and stable that film is now compared to where it was. I didn't think that it could be improved that much, but it really is. This is really raising the bar. And you can find some clips from that at the davisreport.wordpress.com. And when you go there, click on the film banner at the top. It'll take you to the latest post. And you'll see I've got some film clips that'll run for you. They're animations. Just click on them and they'll enlarge. And you'll see for yourself that this film is really, really something special. Now, once I got it cleared up, there's an old saying that if you can improve a photo 1% in resolution, you'll see 10 new things. And that's a little rule of thumb. And it's proven to be true with the Patterson film. And one of the things that I saw that at first I couldn't believe what I was seeing is that she appears to have something on her left side that she is carrying. And when I say carrying, she's not carrying it with her hand. She takes her hand off of it and it swings back and you can see it. And it's much larger than her hand. It's something significant. But it's not in her hand, it's suspended. And how it's suspended, I'm not really sure. It could be suspended by something around the shoulder on that side because you can't see that side. It could be something around the neck that's kind of hidden, in the hair. I don't really know. But it's something that she tries to keep hidden as she makes her walk. She doesn't swing that left hand, but a couple of times she does show her left hand. And definitely is not what the hand is not what I'm seeing. It is something significant to her because she takes care of it. She puts her hand on it, stabilizes it, and keeps it hidden. She doesn't want the two men to see it. Now, it has the look of a light tan, narrow on one end, wide at the upper end, like a cone. So just one of those things where I don't know what it is, but it's very, very interesting. And,
thank you, MK, for joining us. Thank you. And we'll talk to you next month.
Appreciate it.
And now, live on the Alleluia Satellite Ministry Network, from the People's Crystal Cathedral in Hosanna, Utah, we bring you straight out of the desert, the Sunday three-ring service, Jesus Christ is Bored, with your host, the Reverend Robertson Falwell Sheen Moon. Yes, Jesus Christ is Bored, Alleluia, say it. Shout it, Jesus Christ is bored with you. When are you going to get your behind up and do something? So saith the Lord. Now please stand and turn in your hymnals as we sing by Dire Straits, Money for Nothing. And will the ushers please take up the collection as the janitors will please open the windows just a bit, get some air in here.
And now for our daytime drama, The Edge of Wetness, as it is known in the UK, and as it is called in the States, Return to the Planet of the Apes, a commentary on nuclear weapons by Sherwood Ross. Take time to think about it. Don't just say it, whatever, like you do with Fukushima and chemtrails and global warming. All the generations of time are counting on you not to blow it. And remember the words of Charlton Heston.
Oh, my God, I'm back. I'm home. All the time it was, we finally really did it. As he falls to his knees, screaming, "You maniacs! You blew it up! Damn you! God damn you all to hell!"
And now, Sherwood Ross, top scientist warned nuclear bombs deadlier than ever.
What would happen if just one 800 kiloton nuclear warhead was detonated above Midtown Manhattan? Russians reputed to have 10 massive weapons trained on Manhattan, while USA threatens Russian cities in like manner. Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles are believed to carry a total of approximately 1,000 strategic nuclear warheads that can hit the USA less than 30 minutes after being launched. Of this total, about 700 warheads are rated at 800 kilotons. That is, each has the explosive power of 800,000 tons of TNT. What follows is a description of the consequences of the detonation of a single such warhead over Midtown Manhattan in the heart of New York City. The warhead would probably be detonated slightly more than a mile above the city to maximize the damage created by its blast wave. Within a few tenths of millionths of a second after detonation, the center of the warhead would reach a temperature of roughly 200 million degrees Fahrenheit, or about 4 to 5 times the temperature at the center of the sun. A ball of superheated air would form, initially expanding outward at millions of miles per hour. It would act like a fast-moving piston on the surrounding air, compressing it at the edge of the fireball and creating a shockwave of vast size and power. After 1 second, the fireball would be roughly a mile in diameter. It would have cooled from its initial temperature of many millions of degrees to about 16,000 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly 4,000 degrees hotter than the surface of the sun. On a clear day with average weather conditions, the enormous heat and light from the fireball would almost instantly ignite fires over a total area of about 100 square miles. Within seconds after the detonation, fires set within a few miles of the fireball would burn violently. These fires would force gigantic masses of heated air to rise, drawing cooler air from surrounding areas toward the center of the fire zone from all directions.
For the rest of the article, go to veteranstoday.com. Stay tuned next week, maybe, for another episode of Return to the Planet of the Apes, sponsored by Left Behind Adult Diapers. For those who are expecting to be raptured up, but for some odd reason, well, Left Behind Adult Diapers, we are there for you. B-W-R-U-N, beer run. B-W-R-U-N, beer run. All we need is a 10 and a fiver, car and keys and a sober driver. B-W-R-U-N, beer run. We now join in progress another episode of the Wisconsin Daytime Drama Series, sponsored by the Wisconsin Arts Council, hoping you will contribute to their most recent fundraising attempt to get green and gold the recognition they deserve on the state flag, as well as designated summertime vestments for the Wisconsin Catholic Archdiocese of Green Bay. And now we bring you straight out of Kenosha. We find Curly talking to Hal the bartender during happy hour at American Legion Post 99, Hal is just now refilling the plastic peanut bowl.
Schlitz, Hal.
You got it. Coming right up, Curly.
You know, Hal?
What's that, Curly?
On the morning after that famous election way back in 2004, millions of Democrats arose to a new order. Smoke from neoconservative campfires hung all over points southward and westward.
You got that right, Curly. Here you go.
Thanks. The hairy fundamentalist Christian hordes, the redneck blue-collar legions, and other cultural Visigoths stirred beyond distant battlements. in university towns across the country, in San Francisco, Seattle, and Boulder, in that bluest of blue strongholds, New York City, and in every self-contained, oblivious corner of liberal America, where a man or woman can buy a copy of The Nation without special ordering it. Democrats sank into the deepest kind of Prozac-proof depression. What they wondered happened out there in the heartland, the iconographic one they'd seen on televisions and in magazines, the one bright with church spires, Grange halls, stock car races, and community heritage festivals. And why had the working class so plainly voted against their own interests? 2 years later, Democrats regained, for the time being, at least a majority, and liberals had time to contemplate what they saw as the deeply uncultured mob that trounced them. They watched panel discussions on PBS. They argued about where political strategy went wrong, but the one thing the thinking left and urban liberals had not done is tread the soil of Goth. Subject themselves to the unwashed working class of America, to that church-going, hunting and fishing, Bud Light-drinking provincial America, to the people who cannot locate Iraq or France on a map. Few educated liberals will ever find themselves sucking down canned beer at the local dirt track, or listening to the preacher and explain the infallibility of the Bible on every known topic, from biology to the designated hitter rule, or attending awards night at a Christian school, or getting drunk to Teddy and the Starlight Ramblers played C&W at the Eagles Club. Yesterday, behind me in the checkout line at Food Lion were four or five customers who could be twins of the two in front of me, who were telling the checkout clerk how her church rallied to buy her and Eddie a secondhand truck after theirs was repossessed. Those four or five behind, overweight, bad teeth, cheap clothing, looking as though they'd been shot at and missed and shot at and hit. Each of them with his or her own assortment of money, health, and legal problems. I'm sure of it. I know them. When the middle-class citizens of the new suburbs of America, the 20% or so of Americans whose lives most closely resemble media images of the middle class, when they do cross paths with these struggling workers, they do not often see them as struggling. That smiling, wise old fellow in the orange vest in the pipe department at Home Depot, the one who knows everything there ever was to know about plumbing, is limping at age 67 on bad knees and has two bone-grafted discs earned through a life in construction labor. He's working solely to purchase heart medicine and the private insurance he must have if he doesn't want to lose the hospital bills, the rundown bungalow that he and his wife bought in 1964. The one that is now in such a bad neighborhood that only the slumlords ever make an offer for it, but even then, not much. He's been losing ground for 25 years. And if you had lived his hard-working life and had a philosophy of never wanting any handout from the government, you too would be conservative. By conservative, I did not mean a wild-eyed neocon. I mean you would be cautious and traditional enough to vote for the man who looks strong enough to keep housing values up, to destroy your unseen enemies abroad, and to give God a voice in national affairs. The problem is that neither the old fellow at Home Depot nor the rest of us are living and working in 1956 and voting for Eisenhower. Oh, crap, Hal. That's all I can take for today. One more. I got to go. Got to rake the yard or I'm in big trouble.
You got it, Curly. Join us next week for another Wisconsin daytime drama straight out of Kenosha, sponsored by Cheesehead Earbuds, Beverly's Big Bratwurst, and Lake Wasoda Mulch Beer. Our second guest is Anthony Rayson. Anthony is a former Chicago freeway toll booth operator, publisher, and writer. His collection of zines is available online through DePaul University. Anthony publishes Writers Who Inhabit America's Prisons, and we are very lucky to be able to visit with him each month about these writers who he is publishing and corresponding with.
Hello.
Hello, Anthony. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, thank you. Well, today I testified at the Will County Board meeting in Joliet, Illinois. This was concerning the Piton Airport and the Illiana Tollway. They had a resolution to recommend the cessation of eminent domain until a genuine decision has been made by the FAA as to the airport's efficacy. And we have one of our members, who's a county board member. Her name is Judy Ogala. She's vice president of our grassroots group, STAND. So we've been sort of softening this board up for the last 3 or 4 years, trying to educate them about these issues and what they're really doing to the people that they're affecting, and how these issues are felt locally. We go to that meeting sometimes and speak, and you know. And today I brought a fellow friend of mine named Billy Wachowski. He's a retired crane operator who lives out here and is menaced by the airport. He spoke about his Vietnam experiences and how for the last 30 years he and his wife have been menaced by IDOT and other political jackals concerning this airport. So it was a pretty interesting morning, a long morning. There was other business that took forever. But anyway, I thought I'd read you my statement, because you know, I know everyone thinks I'm a big rant and raver, but I can also, I give it to them pretty good anyway. But here goes. This was my statement today to the Will County Board. And this is as in my capacity of outreach coordinator for the group No Illiana for Us, which I co-founded. That's the main opposition to the tollway. I'm outreach coordinator for both groups now. So anyway, greetings. I appreciate your attention in these serious matters. By that, I mean the twin menaces to our communities, the Piton Airport and the Illiana Tollway, both to be financed by Illinois taxpayers, overseen by an obviously corrupt IDOT for the profit of a foreign consortium. And if they don't profit, we have to make up the difference. Absurd on the face of it. Don't let these international sharks prey on our weak financial state. I brought a good friend of mine, Billy Wachowski, today. He's one of the menaced landowners in the Piton Airport footprint. Do put that moratorium on, and soon. We are under siege from this. The only politicians who had the guts to visit with us have been Glenn Pichard, who got the governorship stolen by the corrupt George Ryan, and Al Salvi, who ran for U.S. Senate. So the whole process is pitifully rigged. If you were there with IDOT and NDOT's dog and pony shows in Lowell and Piton to satisfy the community outreach requirements, you'd be full of disgust, too. These are politically driven bad ideas that have no statute of limitations. We've been fighting the Piton Airport for decades. If it was really needed, the airlines would be in the forefront by clamoring for it. They rail against it. These important decisions need to involve the industry involved and the residents and citizens who pay the freight. We are certainly not against fixing transportation problems, such as bottlenecks in Will County. We've even proposed logical road building improvements on our very petition against the Illiana. 394 turns into a two-lane rural road and goes right through Beecher. That's a problem. Piton Wilmington Road is two-lane and goes to close to 20 miles, maybe make it a four-lane. Routes 10 and 24 go east and west, south of the Illiana, so maybe they could be enlarged if an east-west route is so desperately needed. But this is a political deal. It is supposed to relieve traffic in the Chicagoland megalopolis. This no single road could possibly do. Many improvements need to be taken, as does a whole new direction in transportation thinking. High-speed rail is long overdue. These two money pits will suck up all the money, not work, and deprive all other, much more desperately needed improvements from happening. We have a wonderful county, and that's because the people who live here have made it so. Do you realize what a horrific neighbor a major airport and diesel fuel truck tollway would do to the quality of life? It would destroy it, that's what. Cancer rates and asthma for children would skyrocket. Remember Alnack, who wrestled with his board for control of Piatone? They were made up of Jesse Jr.'s main aide and the mayors from around O'Hare. They were desperate to blunt O'Hare expansion by cynically pushing Piatone as this great economic bonanza. They didn't want us to hear about the ear-splitting constant jet noise, the disgusting droppings from planes, the pollution and congestion. Now they're suffering once anew. We should be grateful that we were spared such a fate. That's not what this verdant area was meant for. Crops are. The last major new airport that was in actual use is Denver International. But that was only because they were forced the closing of Stapleton Airport, which was their midway. Do we really expect Piatone to take off without closing Midway? I guess Gary just sits there perfectly good and watches. You can't cut everybody off, yet continue this bad pair of projects. If that does happen, it'll be obvious. You'll have pitted the 1% against the 99%. It'll be corrupt state government against its own farmers. Take sides, folks. So I gave him the sort of the poke in the two eyes, and then my buddy Billy came up there and just told him how it's been physically racking him and his family his whole adult life to this point. He likened it to being stuck with a needle and never having the needle taken out. It's terrible. So anyway, that's what we did. And then they voted 17-4 to recommend the moratorium on pursuing eminent domain cases on these targeted people. So, you know, until IDOT and actually the FAA makes a real decision whether it's a viable, realistic, and necessary project. So that still has not happened after all this time. So there's been decades of foot dragging on this federally, but a lot of pressure from the state on us people locally. So that's one thing I think is important to do. I do focus most of my attention on prisoner publications and prisoner issues, stuff like that, but I also immerse myself seriously in the grassroots fight in my area. You know, the two big things for now are the Piatone Airport and the Ileana Tollway. So luckily we beat back the attempts to put a regional immigration detention center in this area. So that's sort of out in the back burner. They're sort of trying to menace a town in Indiana about that now. So we're helping those people in Indiana to figure out how to stop these bastards from doing that.
Anthony, congratulations on at least a partial success on this airport thing.
Yeah, it's the first step. And, you know, we talked to the reporters and I gave made sure that they all got this address. And we're going to continue on with this. We're going to push the issues on them more and more. And we're trying to get the ear of the governor, basically, because he has the ability to pull the plug on all these horrible projects that have been ongoing for so long. But he can't be trusted. He's a crazy billionaire, you know. He makes Scott of Wisconsin look like a choir boy. He's such an unbelievable corporatist, you know. So who knows what his real plans are. He's going after the state unions mainly right now. But he's the one that really could have some effect on this. He has put like a freeze on all these projects. So at least that's good. They're not trying to hustle people for the Ileana and the airport. They're trying to fast track this Ileana to the twin project with the other one. So. But anyway, yeah, that's good, and we're going to continue on with this. And, you know, I think it's important to really spit out the issues and know in certain terms, you know, there's no reason why we should kowtow to their – because they're declaring war on this area. So we got to defend ourselves, really. It's sickening what's going on. But I'm also getting other groups like this group called the Taxpayers United of America. They're a national taxpayer. They're out of Chicago, their office, but they're around the whole country now trying to – you know, keep government from blowing all kinds of tax money. They too hate the unions and whatever they use taxes for. But they also understand these are horrible boondoggle waste projects. So they're trying to pressure the governor. And basically, they're like libertarians, real right-wingers, you know. But this right-wing governor will listen to guys like that, you know. So we're trying to come at them from every direction, the logical, progressive way of thinking, you know, the ecological, sustaining kind of way of looking at it. And then, you know, all the way from, well, it's just a waste of tax money, which it also is, too. So anyway, I wanted to, I got a couple minutes left. I think I wanted to mention about this interesting project I'm working on. I'm going to be the editor of a journal, a prisoner journal, that's going to be part of the Ida B. Wells Coalition Against Police Brutality and Prison Slavery. They have, you know, it's like a coalition of people that are concerned about these issues, you know. So I'm sort of spearheading the look at the prison part of it, and we're going to come out with this journal. And the deadline was, I think, yesterday for submission. So I got all kinds of incredible submissions. Last month, I read part from this incredible lady, Anastasia Schmidt, prisoner out of Indiana. And she wrote about captive patients, female slaves, and prisoners in 19th century America. It's a historical, it's unbelievably eye-opening about how this happened. The thing that ties it all together to me was this doctor who experimented on these prisoners in Indiana and his precursors, who actually had like a pen of slaves in the backyard, because he lived in the South, he could do that, to experiment on them physically. And but this doctor in the Indianapolis women's prison, his brother-in-law was the guy that spearheaded eugenics. So it all makes perfect sense, you know? And this is the stuff that Hitler grabbed on and said, hey, you know, these are great ideas these Americans come up with. So anyway, that was about that. And but she sent an even more explosive historical analysis about how the whole idea of putting women in prison is to criminalize their sexuality. Because that's how they first became prisoners, was because they were prostitutes or whatever, you know. And then whatever their behavior once inside, even though it's legal behavior, they criminalized it. So the title of her study, is called Shackled Sex: Gender Disparities and the Continued Criminalization of Female Sexuality in Prison. I'm definitely going to use this analysis in this journal, among many other ones. So we're going to have.
Thanks again, Anthony, and we'll talk to you next month.
Very good. Take care. Bye bye.
And now our weekly columnist, Phil Ferrugio, whose articles appear on World News Trust, Dandelion Salad, Truth Out, and many others all over the web. Here it is. It's the Empire, stupid.
Okay, good evening, working stiffs. It's all right, Ma, I'm only bleeding. I just watched Alex Gibney's new documentary on Scientology, Going Clear. What really got to me was how utterly foolish and chronically masochistic many of those former members of this so-called church were. I have studied and even dabbled within one myself during my younger days. I have seen firsthand, through my own vulnerability, how the need to either belong or to feel needed by a group of others can drive one to enter into these cults. Now, the sad reality is that few people, and this is key, ever realize that it is, in fact, a cult that they are joining. What made me literally shout at my television screen while listening to some of those interviewed was, how much crap did you have to take for so many years before you finally saw the light? Watch the film and see for yourself how far people allow themselves to be manipulated and exploited and even tortured. Now, mind you, my experience with cults like Scientology, including my brief visit with Lifespring, an offshoot of EST, revealed to me the vast number of highly educated and seemingly intelligent people who allow themselves to be taken in. I myself was taken in, too. as far as LifeSpring's advanced training course, which consisted of 2 weeks of intensive and expensive mind control. As I began to speak one-on-one with some of the others sharing the experience with me, I realized how many overly sensitive and needy folks like myself and recovering addicts and alcoholics that there were. The need to belong and to feel wanted can be so great. Now, having gone through 3 years of intensive Freudian analysis, I can see how cults like Scientology and Est and LifeSpring copied much from standard psychoanalysis. Then they tweaked it a bit and renamed it something else. Having studied how far our government has used various techniques of outright torture, especially in regard to this ongoing Orwellian war on terror, I can see how cults copy those techniques and refine them a bit, all for the same heinous purpose, control. Having spent more than half my adult life studying the entire Nazi movement right through World War II, I can see how much of what Hitler's gang did with their mass rallies and pomp and circumstance has and is being mirrored by cults like Scientology. Seeing the leaders of this cult and its top executives dressed in uniforms that resemble those worn by movie ushers from the 1930s and 40s, one has to laugh at the audaciousness of it all. Yet it is real. Thousands attend those spectacles and cheer and applaud, just like those fools did in 1930s Germany. Or how about the overflowing crowds who follow those TV preachers and send their hard-earned savings for prayer cloths and other nonsense? Now, allow me to go one step further. 1 year from now, we will have our next presidential horse race. Check out the conventions they hold for those two major political parties. You will then realize why cults like Scientology have been so successful. To this writer, the two-party system here in our dear America has been the longest-lasting cult in our nation's history. As with the inane British Tory versus Labor con job, our own Republican versus Democrat garbage has for so long scammed so many good, decent Americans. So do the research and see how the really key issues and policy decisions that keep this American empire going full speed always have the consensus of the two political parties. It has to, or the wizards behind the curtain would do some pruning to make certain of it. Cults, any and all, suck. Is it a time for more Americans to connect the dots? Thank you.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polacek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard.
Although the United States, in the words of columnist Nicholas Kristof, is the most powerful colossus in the history of the world, it lags significantly in quality of life for its citizens. In the Social Progress Index 2015, the U.S. does not make the top 10 or even top 15. The global study measured basic human needs, foundations of well-being, and opportunity. Overall, the U.S. comes in at 16th, and some indices are particularly startling. As Kristof writes in the New York Times, the index ranks the United States 30th in life expectancy, 38th in saving children's lives, and a humiliating 55th in women surviving childbirth. Okay, we know that we have a high homicide rate, but we're at risk in other ways as well. We have higher traffic fatality rates than 37 other countries and higher suicide rates than 80. Of the 133 countries rated, Central African Republic comes in last, right after Chad and Afghanistan. In a time of ever greater economic inequality, it's worth remembering that everything isn't just dandy. If some Americans are doing extremely well, what counts is how we are doing as a people.
A group of military veterans is taking aim at U.S. drone strikes overseas with graphic TV ads directly asking Air Force pilots to stop flying the unmanned aircraft, calling the operations immoral and illegal. The ads are the first commercials opposing U.S. drone operations ever shown on American TV, according to sponsors, which include the Veterans Democratic Club of Sacramento County and the Sacramento Chapter of Veterans for Peace. The campaign is spearheaded by an activist website, nodrones.com, K-N-O-W-drones.com. The commercials are airing this month on Comcast in Northern California. Communities near Beale Air Force Base, which is home to Golden Hawk reconnaissance drones. Pilots at Beale remotely fly the spy drones over areas believed to be controlled by terrorists in foreign countries and pinpoint human targets for attack by armed predator and reaper drones. The two 15-second spots show images from a drone operation, a video screen, an explosion, and civilian searching through rubble after a drone attack. On-screen messages read, drone killings violate law and morality, and drone pilots, please refuse to fly. No one has to obey an immoral law. One of the ads, which includes images of dead and mutilated children, is being run only after 10 p.m., while the other spot airs from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. daily. Both are posted on YouTube. Activists plan to run the anti-drone spots near operation centers throughout the U.S. The campaign began last month in the Las Vegas TV market near Creech Air Force Base, which is home to predator drones. Nick Mottern, coordinator of NoDrones.com, said this week that the ads are aimed directly at drone pilots, support workers, and their families. He criticized Barack Obama in Congress for supporting drone attacks and likened the ad campaign to Catholic Archbishop Oscar Romero's call to Salvadoran soldiers in 1980 to lay down their arms during that country's civil war. I think pilots and other people in these positions are under intense pressure to do this work, said Mottern, a Navy veteran who served in the Vietnam War. Our ads challenge them to stop compartmentalizing their work and to engage their consciences. Bellucci, who is an Army information specialist in the Vietnam War, said most Americans don't hear the whole story about drone attacks. We want to get the word out. You hear that they are saving American lives, but you don't really hear about the innocent women and children being targeted on the ground. Bellucci said the ads are scheduled to air on Comcast through April on base at Beale, as well as in Yuba City, Marysville, Wheatland, Linda, Live Oak, Colusa, and Olivehurst. Supporters hope to raise $4,000 to expand the ads to the Sacramento TV market, he said, and another $8,000 to $10,000 is being budgeted to buy spots within the next 30 days at two other drone operation centers in New York and Mexico.
From Citizens for Legitimate Government, legitgov.org. Secret CIA fund adds millions to Al-Qaeda coffers. ACLU files new lawsuit over Obama administration drone kill list. U.S. trained and armed Iraqi forces investigated for war crimes. UN torture expert refused access to Guantanamo Bay and U.S. federal prisons.
That's all, folks. That's the news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck. And so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. Be all you can be. At the end of the day, it is what it is. Have a good day. Bring something to the table, and you will start the revolution today when you make direct eye contact with the next policeman you pass. Our next guest is Larry Pinkney. Larry Pinkney comes to us each month from Minneapolis. He contributed the foreword to the new book by Cindy Sheehan called The Obama Files. Larry is a veteran of the Black Panther Party, the former Minister of Interior of the Republic of New Africa, a former political prisoner, and the only American to have successfully self-authored his civil rights, political rights case to the United Nations under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights in connection with his political organizing activities. Pinkney was interviewed in 1988 on the nationally televised PBS NewsHour, formerly known as the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour, and more recently on the nationally syndicated Alex Jones Show and RT, formerly known as Russia Today. He is currently founder and curator of the Black Activist Writers Guild. Pinkney is a former university instructor of political science and international relations, and his writings have been published in various places, including the Boston Globe, San Francisco Bayview newspaper, Black Commentator, Intrepid Report, Global Research, and many others. He is in the archives of Dr. Huey P. Newton, co-founder of the Black Panther Party.
Hello, Larry.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
How are you? Thank you. My message today is fairly succinct and to the point, so if it's okay, I'd like to go right into it.
Please do.
Okay. I want to begin by saying please, please, please to all of our sisters and brothers, do not be fooled and tempted again by the propaganda of the Democrat and Republican media machinery, specifically or especially as it pertains to the upcoming 2016 so-called U.S. presidential so-called election. First of all, this is not an election process. What it is, it's a selection process among millionaires and billionaires, not the everyday, ordinary black, white, brown, red, and yellow people of this nation. We need to remember that. Also, let's remember that it has actually been correctly said that, quote, America is like a melting pot. The people at the bottom get burned and the scum floats to the top, end of quote. Let's remember that. That says quite a bit. We are everyday, ordinary, struggling people. It is time for us to take our destinies in our own hands outside of the so-called Democrat and Republican parties. There is no substantive difference between the Democrats and Republicans, especially on the federal level. Now, for example, the same Hillary, or I call her and other folks call her Hillary, but the same Hillary Clinton, who passes herself off as a so-called progressive, is the very same Wall Street embedded pro-war politician who said concerning the bloody, bloody U.S. foray into the sovereign North African nation of Libya that, quote, this is her quote, "We came, we saw, he died," end of quote, referring, of course, to the murder of the then head of state of Libya and to the subsequent de facto destruction of that sovereign African nation. So let's not be fooled. Please, let's be critical thinkers. What do we need to do? We need to concentrate on bringing about real change locally, and linking up with other localities locally who are struggling to do the same thing. Do not be fooled again. Look outside of the corporate-owned, corporate-controlled Democrat and Republican parties, which are really nothing more than superficially different sides of the very same systemically rotten coin or political party. So, having said that, I'm not going to belabor this. I want to thank everyone for allowing me the opportunity to present my small, succinct thoughts to all of my sisters and brothers. Let me end by saying all power to the people. Each one, reach one. Each one, teach one. Onward, then, my sisters and brothers, onward, so that we can bring about real systemic change.
While we have you still connected, Larry, since we have another, 7 minutes or so, okay. why don't we just chat a bit? what's actually going on in your area? What projects are you working on?
Well, actually, I am working on both the local and regional and national level simultaneously. I'm working on, I'm the national spokesperson at the presently for Reverend Edward Pinckney. His name is the same as mine, but we're not related, at least not biologically related, who was imprisoned in Berrien County, Michigan, specifically he's imprisoned in Michigan. He is from Benton Harbor, Berrien County, Michigan, and he was framed and set up because he dared to try and organize the community, and he was very effective at it, to expose the fact that Whirlpool Corporation, which is actually headquartered in the little township of Benton Harbor, is actually headquartered there, as I said. And he was standing up to them and had organized a recall election. It was going to, and it was actually moving forward very, very strongly. So the powers that be, of course, decided that he had to be neutralized. They charged him falsely with election fraud with no evidence. Nevertheless, he was convicted, by the way, by an all-white jury. Color doesn't matter except for the fact that Benton Harbor is over 90% African-American or Black American, and not one Black was on that jury. Not one! Not to mention two or three. Not one. This is ridiculous for anybody of any color or ethnicity. So this is what I'm doing. I'm doing my utmost to wake up everybody, Black, white, brown, red, and yellow, that an attack against one of us is an attack against all of us. I'm urging, we're linking up the campaign to, as I just said earlier, localities, local places, such as places in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, such as Oakland, California, such as New York City, very specific parts of New York City, such as Detroit. And these are all areas that are fighting locally. They're fighting against corporate hegemony, corporate domination and control of the judicial process, as well as the police, as well, you name it, they control it. But they're fighting hard. So I'm in the process of linking that up, this struggle, because it's not just really about Reverend Edward Pinckney. It's about all of us. And we it's time for us to make these connections. We've got to make the connections. We're not alone. This struggle is happening all over the country in different local communities all over the country. So I'm heartened, and at the same time I'm very, of course, dissatisfied with the way the system has functioned thus far. But I'm not surprised. None of us should be. That's why I always call for, the word I use is systemic change, not superficial change, because superficial change is no change at all. So that's what I have been doing and am doing.
Well, looking back over the several decades that we've been around, do you see what sort of changes do you see? What sort of systemic changes do you see? Is the violence getting worse or better? Is the oppression? Is there a difference? Can you address that?
I think that the oppression, the systemic oppression, has become more insidious than it was, say, for example, back in the 1960s and 1970s. We now have approximately four or at most five corporations that control the entire news media, the entire news media in this country. In the 60s and 70s, we had, it was not quite that bad. We did have a few more opportunities in terms of, or at least different news organizations. Now, we might as well just say we have one propaganda machine, because they all work together. So in that sense, it's much worse. Now, the positive side of it, though, is this. I believe that people, and I can clearly see both locally and nationally, that people are fed up. They are beginning to see through the veneer. They're beginning to see through the farce, if you will. And I'm very, very heartened by that. Young people are also waking up. But it's our job, those of us who've been around a few years, to direct that legitimate rage into getting our sisters and brothers to organize locally and to link up with other localities that are doing the same thing. So, I don't know. I hope I've in some fashion addressed what you asked.
Well, you certainly did. And It is my hope that the continuing dumbing down process that is encouraged by government and a lot of the education does not kill off that those changes.
It is also my hope. It is also my hope, Chuck, and quite frankly, I believe that the brainwashing, dumbing down process is actually beginning to backfire. But it's our job as conscious folks to utilize that and to remind people that we have other alternatives, beginning with ourselves. We are the alternative.
Say, Larry, real quick, is the police violence now remind you at all of the 60s?
It does, except in the fact it's obviously very, very similar. The only difference is that now, because people have cell phones with cameras, they have all kinds of electronic equipment, now you can see it. You can see it. It's not like it's any different. It's not. People need to understand this has been going on for decades and decades, but now people are actually seeing it on their computers, on their phones, on their screens.
Well, it looks like we have to call it a night, but thank you so much, and we'll talk to you again next month.
All right. Thank you. Love you. Take care, brother.
And now it's time for the new situation comedy known in the UK as Just Shoot Me and in the USA as Leave It to Cleaver. Don't you know you want a revolution? Well, you know, we all want to change the world. We talk about a revolution. Is this the revolution? Free candy during the 4th of July parade? 2-for-1 liters of Diet Pepsi at Walmart. Is that the revolution? The media is corrupt. Politics are corrupt. Wages are no good. No health care, housing, food prices. People just can't live. Voting will do no good. Marching will do no good. How about fasting? How about burning yourself in the middle of the intersection? How about breaking into the convenience store? How about shooting someone in power? Is that the way to do it? Violence, nonviolence, or just take a nap? Switch the channel, go get some beer. Well, let's take a look at it. Go here. Guerrilla War in the United States, www.historyisaweapon.com. And then go here, the Jericho Movement, www.thejerichomovement.com. You say you want a revolution. And now, please join us as we join In Progress, a National Press Club Hall of Fame presentation with our guests, Philip Berrigan, Thomas Merton, Marilyn Buck, Daniel Berrigan, George Jackson, and Hunter S. Thompson. Now making his way to the podium, Daniel Berrigan.
We've assumed the name of peacemakers, but we have been, by and large, unwilling to pay any significant price. And because we want the peace with half a heart and half a life and will, the war, of course, continues because the waging of war by its nature is total. But the waging of peace by our own cowardice is partial. So a whole will and a whole heart and a whole national life bent toward war prevail over the velleities of peace. In every national war since the founding of the Republic, we have taken for granted that war shall exact the most rigorous cost, and that the cost shall be paid with cheerful heart. We take it for granted that in wartime, families will be separated for long periods. Men will be imprisoned, wounded, driven insane, killed on foreign shores. In favor of such wars, we declare a moratorium on every normal human hope for marriage, for community, for friendship, for moral conduct towards strangers and the innocent. We are instructed that deprivation and discipline, private grief and public obedience are to be our lot. And we obey, and we bear with it, because bear we must, because war is war, and good war or bad, we're stuck with it and its cost. But what of the price of peace? I think of the good, decent, peace-loving people I have known by the thousands, and I wonder how many of them are so afflicted with the wasting disease of normalcy that even as they declare for the peace, their hands reach out with an instinctive spasm in the direction of their loved ones, the direction of their comforts, their home, their security, their income, their future, their plans. That 20-year plan of family growth and unity, that 50-year plan of decent life and honorable natural demise. Of course, let us have the peace, we cry. But at the same time, let us have normalcy. Let us lose nothing. Let our lives stand intact. Let us know neither prison nor ill repute nor disruption of ties. And because we must encompass this and protect that, and because at all costs, our hopes must march on schedule, and because it is unheard of that in the name of peace, a sword should fall, disjoining that fine and cunning web that our lives have woven, because it is unheard of that good men and women should suffer injustice, or family be sundered, or good repute be lost, because of this, we cry, peace, peace, and there is no peace. There is no peace, because the making of peace is at least as costly as the making of war, at least as exigent, at least as disruptive, at least as liable to bring disgrace and prison and death in its wake.
Join us next week for the National Press Club Hall of Fame Hour, sponsored by Wheaties, Lemon Pledge, Razor Wire Dental Floss, Lucky Strike Cigarettes, and Raid Underarm Deodorant, with guests George Jackson, Marilyn Buck, Thomas Merton, and Hunter S. Thompson. Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown at the end of the empire. Duluth is a microbrewery of what is going on everywhere, where the people fight to have some sort of say and leave it to the outlaws to come up with something. Leave it to the guys in the jails and carrying skateboards, leaning up against the light pole at 2 a.m. to come up with something. It's the home of Piker, McNugget, Carol Kopecky, Frosty Pine, Winnie Bloodfeather, some 23 Toyvonens, Diamond Griffin, and Penny Jones. Families from Minneapolis and St. Paul and St. Peter and Mankato and Des Moines thundering up Interstate 35 hit full throttle on Friday afternoon, accelerating past Hinckley and Sandstone, past Pine City, Barnum, Cloquet to get away. They let their hair down to get bugs and branches in their hair. You turn your phone to vibrate or heave it into the ditch, grenade style. Change your radio from WCCO to the Moose. Up and up and around and over the hill, and there it is, the view, Lake Superior, the big lake. And there's the lift bridge in Morgan Park, and New Page paper plant, the bridges to Superior, Wisconsin, the bay, the big boats. Turn right to Canal Park for the tourists. Turn left, uphill, for those who have already decided to stay. Duluth is big burritos and apricot wheat beer and a parade to celebrate cold weather. Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings, like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 a.m, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops, and it's adventure, and it's being able to be yourself. But Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite, guns, tattoos, bowling brawls, Bigfoot, and ball games. It's laser tag. It's the bomb. It's the gold. We continue our story with Sonny Castillo just now getting released from the prison at Moose Lake. And if there is time, we will meet Diamond Griffin on her birthday, her death day, that is.
See ya, said the guard. Sonny kept going along the sidewalk, somehow putting distance between herself and the giant maroon brick wall. She turned to look over her right shoulder at her room to see the bars from this side. Instead, her eyes stopped her head from turning by noticing a little park with a circle of trees and a circle of benches inside the trees where visitors waited, where some of the staff ate lunch in the summer. She hated it. She had a name for it, Dante's Park. She smelled the meat on the grill and leaves burning. She felt the sidewalk through the thin shoes. She mentally checked everywhere to see how her clothes fit without looking. Keeping her eyes straight, her mouth closed, so nobody in this new world could tell she was afraid. Sunny's heart leaped inside her blue flannel shirt at the sudden shout of the train. She kept going, wanting to look back. She'd not seen the prison from this view for 22 months. But the saying went, well, anyway. Sunny looked both ways four times crossing the street to get from the prison grounds to the residential zone. They'd told her 100 times how to get to the liquor store bus stop. Turn right at the light. Keep going, you'll see it. Safely across the street, she paused to turn halfway toward the sign on the corner. Minnesota Correctional Facility at Moose Lake. Nice sign, she thought, and color. Green trees, the lake, birds, like the place was an asset to the community. Probably was. Jobs, stuff like that, she thought. For sex offenders, Sunny said silently in her head as she turned and continued. She moved on the walk right close to the highway. She glided, did not feel her feet moving, like with one of those moving belts at the Minneapolis airport. Traffic zoomed by at 30 miles per hour. She wished they'd slow down. It was so loud. She'd watched the scene from her window for night after night and afternoons that refused to end. And now she was here. Couldn't be. She could not be here. She was never going to be here. This was never going to happen. There it was. Northland Liquor. She walked inside and asked, where was the bus depot? The manager pointed to a yellow plastic chair by the door. Sunny sat with her bag in her lap, looking out the glass door to the parking lot, the traffic light and the cars and the trucks on the main drag going through town. She saw people walking, hauling groceries by hand home from some market. Sunny leaned forward to see more as they walked off and away from her glass door movie screen. She moved forward on the cold chair, leaning forward, scrunching her bag, pushing something hard inside into her stomach. She edged out, just keeping her butt in touch with the chair. More cars, more people walking. They're talking, laughing. Sunny leaned forward, daring to become detached from her chair, all her weight on her thighs and ankles. It looks like the people walking past now are motioning, talking to the people ahead of them who had passed before. And now there could be more people behind them because one in their group is walking backwards, smiling, motioning, laughing. Excuse me. Deep voice was right behind her. She'd done something bad. Sunny looked up and tried to look behind her, but she was so out of position she could not find anything. She reached back and fell into midair, wondering where she might land. Her breath caught somewhere between her throat and her heart. She landed on the chair with a squeak and a crash as it pushed back against the plaster wall. A big man in a big, puffy, warm jacket with a law enforcement patch on the shoulder, wearing a tan Border Patrol cap, looked down at her and nodded as he passed and pushed out the door. Here, he said, the man standing behind the counter. "Here," he said again. Sonny realized he was speaking to her and looked back his way with wonderment in her eyes to say, "Excuse me? Bus is here." Oh, yeah, sure, thank you. She got up, grabbed her bag, dropped it, picked it up, looked back at the man and waved just as he nodded slightly. The bus lumbered up into the drive up to the liquor store glass door. The driver wheezed open. The driver stared down at Sonny, standing flat-footed on the cool cement as if he'd been staring in that direction all week. She put a foot up on the steps, hungry to be gone, gulping three at a time. The driver looked at her as she stopped to dig into her pants pockets for change or money, knowing there could not be any money in there. They'd given her release money, but had she left it on the counter? Oh, no. Or could it be in her duffel? Sonny smiled shyly, knowing the driver was staring because she was so tall or something. She dug both hands into her back pockets, all the while looking at the newspaper on the floor at the driver's feet. "Which way?" the driver said. Sonny smiled and said, "Which way are you going?" while patting everywhere for the hiding money. The local paper featured Sonny's photo, her faculty photo from the Crown Lake High School yearbook of 3 years ago. The story told about Sonny Castillo being released today, how she was from California, came to the University of Minnesota, and as a first-year journalism teacher, yearbook sponsor, junior varsity basketball. Sonny had read the whole story last night in her room. "You're the one," the driver looked at her and spoke without speaking. Their eyes on the same plane. Sonny found the folded money in her front pocket and drew it out. The driver made a motion to her to come on up, then we got to get going. "Thanks. No." Sonny stepped backwards and down without looking, keeping her eyes on the driver. She stepped back one step from the bus as the door closed and the bus left, wobbling like a settler's wagon over the invisible bumps in the concrete lot. Diamond Griffin placed her phone down and looked in the mirror. Before sliding the birthday card into its reserved spot on the glass, she read it again. "Are you afraid?" The outside had all the happy birthday greetings and transitioned to the inside paragraph. The handwritten, "Are you afraid?" in neat cursive adult font over the top was the only human touch. She was afraid. This was her death year. All the other children were gone. They'd received the same cards each September the 11th until they died. Diamond had been afraid all those years, too, at least since she could read. Her mother and father had never read the others to her or explained, but they also did not deny her the cards when they came in the box along with all the others from aunties and cousins. The parents of those children born on September 11, 2001 at St. Luke's had been so happy. They played cards together and stood together beaming through the glass at their children, hearing the faint music through the thick glass. "I'm proud to be an American." There were 10 children in the nursery at the time that Diamond was there. She, the only black child. One of them died each year since then in mysterious circumstances. The parents' group ended after 2 or 3 years because of the early deaths of the children, not knowing whom to invite now and not really wanting to interrupt their own joy with condolences, and then the mystery of it all, life and death. Each year on her birthday, Diamond received a birthday card in the mail that said, "Are you afraid?" along with copies of newspaper clippings of the anthrax letters that also had that phrase included. Each of her other Are You Afraid cards stuck from her mirror and almost outlined her face perfectly. She stuck the last one in, and there she was. Her braided pigtails in her nose and her mouth and her eyes, just over her left shoulder, a bouquet of red and yellow roses, sat in the seat of her wheelchair, waiting their turn to give birthday wishes to the queen for the day. One day, her parents would be in this mirror, squeezing their heads together inside the paper ring inside the round mirror, tears flooding their eyes and their faces, setting the last newspaper clipping in place to complete the circle. Diamond Griffin knew this. Keeping her big brown eyes on the mirror, she reached to her right with one hand and touched the leathery sorting hat she'd received some Christmas. She took it in both hands and placed it gently upon her crown like a crown. The thing was faux-worn and floppy, and they were. Diamond scrunched her eyes and nose and mouth as if she were thinking something deep. Gryffindor! Her finger pointed toward the ceiling. Her face became bright and free. Her teeth gleamed and she flapped a wave to her mother behind her. I'll put these in water. Be back soon. Her mother clutched up the flowers and shoved her face into them on her way out. The family had come to Duluth, to the downtown Hillside neighborhood, for a funeral from Chicago. Well before Diamond was born. And they'd stayed. Are you going anywhere? She shouted and heard the water running and a muted, not that I know of. Can we go to the mall, to the buffet? Her mother came back, picking at the flowers to get them just right in the glass vase. She set them in the dresser at the window. I thought we'd do something here tonight, just us. Your father's at Menards. After he fixes my sink, I'll make something. We've got an ice cream cake, she beamed. What I really want is a wand. Diamond turned to her mother, tried to speak British. She bowed, keeping the hat on her head with one hand, held up her other hand, an exaggerated fencing sort of fist to emphasize, you see a wand? I don't see no wand here. Her mother grinned and gathered up the wheelchair and placed it into position in the matter of a chariot or a pumpkin that is, in its essence, its very soul, is actually a princess carriage. Diamond sat with dignity and hurried her mother with a princess flap of the hand and raised chin to put down the iron footrest and fasten her shoes and braces as if they were magic slippers. On the way to Target to try and find a wooden or plastic wand or maybe a Star Wars lightsaber that would serve the purpose, Diamond looked out her window. Her mother slid her hand slowly to the radio dial and peeked at the digital changer thing to get the classical music channel. Diamond let it go and watched the people on the street. If she could walk, she would walk everywhere. If she could walk for one day, she would walk all day. She'd walk up and down the hills of downtown and out past the mansions on London Road and out as far as the big lighthouse. She'd sit on the rocks and watch the Lakers and the Salties, and she'd close her eyes to be able to hear the symphony of the gulls and the waves and the shooshing on the rocks. And she'd sit for a while and she'd decide whether it was time to go or not. And she'd maybe open one eye just a little, then close her eyes and let herself be taken up, way up, up and out over the water. And from there, she would not hear anything that anyone was used to hearing. She'd hear new things that birds and angels and demons heard from someplace else. She'd take a deep breath and come back to her rock and she'd get up and walk again. They drove on down 2nd Street, past the statue of the naked family swinging each other by the arms for some reason in front of Northland General, and the hospital workers in the plastic bus stop station waiting, and the men and women toting their gym bags to the fitness center inside where they would lift weights and swim and sit naked in the sauna. Mother turned left, up towards central entrance, past the Whole Foods co-op, moving out of the grid a bit, toward the universities, towards the stores, the mall, Target. Towards the stores, the mall, Target.
And that's the news from Duluth, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security, COINTELPRO, lone gunmen are about average.
And that brings us right near the end of another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. Once again, we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported, and they need your support. I'd like to thank all of you for listening and our wonderful guests. And thank you, Mike, and good night.
Yes, thanks to our guests, Phil Ferruccio, Larry Pinkney, Anthony Rayson, and M.K. Davis. Also credit and thanks to Joe Badgett. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to theshow.newamericandream.info. And as always, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. Good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Krista Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Mohammed Atta. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.